are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, March 15th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Heather Parton, or as you may know her, Digby. It's Casual Friday, folks. We're going to look back on the week that was, probably also just the last 24 hours. Then later in the program, we will be joined by Matthew Film Guy, who will ostensibly give us a film to watch over the weekend. Meanwhile, 49 dead in New Zealand as a white supremacist attacks a mosque, obviously killing children along with men and women who were attending that mosque. The killer remains alive to ostensibly have his opportunity to explain why he was justified in his killing, in his mind. Meanwhile, new report, the Arctic is warming at a devastating pace, and it is locked in. Virtually, in practicality, no way to stop it. We would have to take extreme measures. Well, let me rephrase that. The only way to stop it would be extreme measures. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court in Connecticut, Connecticut State Supreme Court, okays a lawsuit against the Sandy Hook gun makers. And the Senate rejects Trump's emergency declaration. Steve Mnuchin says he'll protect Trump's tax returns despite the statutory power of Congress to see them. North Korea threatens to suspend talks with the U.S. And in a lead up to the Supreme Court case, Wilbur Ross lies about the census questions. And while a federal judge is soon to decide if Republicans can restrict Medicaid to people with jobs only. Beto O'Rourke's anti-ACA Social Security record on the table now. That was quick.
Boo, Beto, boo.
Does Trump have a Chinese scandal as well?
See, I'm not racist.
And lastly, AFL-CIO gives their Human Rights Award to Lula da Silva. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, just a horrible shooting in New Zealand. And 49 dead in Christchurch, New Zealand. Gunman live streamed himself, taking his guns out of his car, walking into, just walking up the driveway, and then begins to shoot everyone around him. He is arrested. He's a man in his late 20s. And I believe he's an Australian, actually. Not sure why he went to New Zealand. Maybe he lived in New Zealand. I'm not quite clear. The guy has gone on to say, you know, that he's been inspired by folks like Candace Owens. Who knows if that's the case or not, but that's what he claims. He has a manifesto which claims that New Zealand is for people of European descent. We will dig into this a little bit later, but, you know, what is there to say? There's going to be a lot of claims, of course, and we'll play some of these, that this guy's, it's really not a political thing. He's just crazy. Now, I want to make it clear, obviously, all white people aren't like this. Which is exactly, you know, what we would need to hear is from, you know, white leaders now coming up and preaching moderation in this instance.
And you just don't hear any noises. You just don't hear any noises from the white leaders saying, hey, we need to get this under control. These are bad ideas.
Right.
He said he admired Donald Trump. You don't hear any noises from the Trump administration saying we condemn these ideas.
Right. You know, this is the, not sure what there is much to say beyond that. We will talk more about that as the program goes on. Meanwhile, as you know, yesterday, Beto announced that he was jumping in the race with the speech. Did you guys play that video yesterday?
The announcement video?
Yeah.
No, we played the CNN, like, word fragment West Wing
the
video.
Rousing.
Yeah, it wasn't tremendously dynamic, that video. And, of course, the reason why he's gaining this much attention is because on day one, he has the second biggest network, fundraising network, of any of the people in the race. Second, obviously, to Bernie Sanders' fundraising network, at least in terms of, you know, what we established with grassroots. And he's got some pretty strong grassroots campaigners. Unfortunately for him, I think, or maybe fortunately for him, depending on who the Democratic electorate is, his policies in the past have tracked to the right of almost everyone in the race. I would say probably definitively, you know, in terms of stated positions and votes, I don't think there is a more conservative candidate in the Democratic race. The question is how much will he be able to sort of deflect from his record and his voting record? And so we'll talk more about that, I think, with Digby. But here, this was fascinating, and this was this morning. There is, after the interview with Joe Scarborough a couple of days ago, where Hickenlooper from Colorado refused to say that he was a capitalist, which was just an absolutely bizarre situation. And I think indicative of what the candidates in the race must be aware of, particularly a guy like Hickenlooper, is that the Democratic Party, the primary voters, have moved to the left. And if you want to, at the very least, be part of the conversation, you need to project that to the rest of the party, which is, you know, the problem that Beto is going to have. However, this has set off alarm bells for a lot of people across the board, not just on the Joe Scarborough show, but I would imagine in the Democratic Party, but certainly a guy like Donnie Deutsch, who is was having his own little freak out. And this is a fascinating exchange, too. This is Joe Scarborough and Donnie Deutsch. Donnie Deutsch just bemoaning the fact that, and these terms are thrown around, capitalists, socialists. I mean, they, in the context of our politics, they don't really mean that much in terms of, like, when we talk about all the candidates who are running in this race, and to the extent that we talk about anything that is actual practical politics within the U.S., these two terms don't mean that much, frankly. But here are these two.
Joe, I'm going to take it one step further, because this is how dangerous socialism. I find Donald Trump reprehensible as a human being, but a socialist candidate is more dangerous to this country as far as the strength and well-being.
Pause it for 1 second. First off, and we should go back. We live in a country, not a company. I should just remind that.
There.
Yeah, indeed. But there is no socialist candidate who is running in our election. Maybe there might, someone from the Socialist Party might be running. I don't know if they're going to get on the ballot anywhere. But, I mean, Bernie Sanders, I think for the vast majority of his career, identified as a socialist. But in terms of like what he is running on, and in terms of the way that he's identifying himself today, he is not proposing a socialist country, I think, in the way that Donnie Deutsch wants to make it out to be. Maybe he is, because Donnie Deutsch, I think, has a very sort of wide range of what he considers socialism.
I would say if it's economic decisions are made democratically and not by capitalists, Donnie Deutsch would consider that socialism.
Maybe he would. Let's listen.
As a human being, but a socialist candidate is more dangerous to this country as far as the strength and well-being of our country than Donald Trump. I would vote for Donald Trump, a despicable human being.
No, you won't.
Let me tell you
something.
Stop
yourself.
Let me correct myself. Thank you, Joe. Thank you. Let me tell
myself. You will never vote for a bigot, a guy that's made bigoted statements for the past 3 years.
Joe, thank you for correcting me. I stand corrected to that. I will be so distraught to the point that could even come out of my mouth if we have a socialist at that, because that will take our country so down. And we are not we are not Denmark. I love Denmark. You know, that's not who we are. And if you love who we are and all the great things that still have to have binders put on the side, please step away from the socialism.
Stop.
And let me correct myself. Yeah. I will never vote for Donald Trump. Thank you, Joe.
Okay, very good. Fools rush in, Donnie. Videotape us forever.
Here's my
chin. Write that down.
Here's my chin right there.
And by the way.
Yeah.
That's Howard Schultz.
That was just so
that's
bizarre.
Howard Schultz.
But, I mean, it does raise this question. Now, so, you know, presumably Donnie Deutsch is talking about Bernie Sanders, right? I mean, who else would he be talking about?
Yeah,
and
he's,
the
he's
idea. Let me just finish what I'm saying. And the idea that Donnie Deutsch is threatening to vote for Donald Trump until he's, you know, told by his television guy, like, look, we're not going to go there in the context of this. This is, yeah, right. We've got to make a marketing decision here. This is, you know, the argument that needs to happen now. Like, there needs to be, just like there was a requirement for more or less pledges across the board. Now is the time to make these pledges. Will you support the Democratic nominee? Because to the extent that people talk about Bernie Sanders supporters abandoning Clinton in the general election, the numbers are in. Was it Stokes in the Washington Post? Has shown, we're talking about 12% of Bernie Sanders supporters from the primary voted for Donald Trump. Almost double, depending on which study you look at, Hillary Clinton's in 2008. Somebody tweeted at me, do you think it's possible that, 9% of Barack Obama supporters in 2008 voted for John McCain? Yes, there was a big push, and maybe this makes up for some of Hillary Clinton's votes as well. There was a big push in 2008 by Rush Limbaugh called Operation Chaos, and it was for Republicans to cross over in these elections, in the primary elections, where you did not have to declare your party. And I'm quite convinced that at least half of those, Maybe a third of those Obama voters went and voted for John McCain because they were actual Republicans. But also, you got to remember, John McCain was, and this might also contribute to why you had so many Clinton voters who voted for John McCain. John McCain was considered by a lot of Democrats to be much more reasonable, I think, than Donald Trump was. And but nevertheless, the numbers don't lie. But the question is here is, how many of Donnie Deutsch Democrats are going to vote for Donald Trump or are going to basically vote for some third party, their version of a Green Party candidate, to avoid voting for the Democratic nominee if it's Bernie Sanders. And these people need to be held to account in the same way that we would hold any the people who in 2016 would have gone and voted for someone other than Hillary Clinton. And so this is a good a moment to look in both into, like, you know, how Joe Scarborough wants to brand himself, but also into what could be a significant problem unless it's addressed early.
And also, I would just add to that, Jamal Bowie has a tweet out because there's this new, you know, of course, totally delusional piece in New York Magazine, and the spin from the Howard Schultz team is, the backlash must mean we're on to something. And, you know, of course, it's, and all the quotes are obviously either from just enabling friends or the same advisors who want to make a run on this guy. But Jamal Bowie's quote is basically, I forget, I'm paraphrasing, but something effective, I'm increasingly convinced that he just wants to get the president reelected. And I think that I agree.
That Howard Schultz does.
Yes. And because I think there's degrees of it. I think you're right. I think Donnie Deutsch is saying Bernie Sanders. And obviously the piece where the Wall Street guys said, they named it. They said Sanders or Warren.
Right.
But I think in a Schultz case and with some of these other guys, they are such babies that they're living enough that, you know, a Booker or a Harris is even migrating with where the rest of the party is. And they might want to just spoil the whole thing because they're so bratty, entitled, and delusional.
I mean, I find that hard to believe, but I also don't find it hard to believe that they are delusional enough to think that they're going to have they could save the country.
Surely
well,
Schultz,
they think
Schultz
they're
is
saving
super
the country if they throw it to Trump.
I don't know,
like,
about that.
The fact that he said we're not Denmark when he was trying to explain socialism tells you all you need to know about this guy's ideology. I mean, Denmark is not a socialist country. It's not even the most socialist of the Scandinavian countries, by the way. Like, people in Finland think Denmark's like a bunch of free market wage cucks. But, like, this is what
that's what the prime minister of Finland said at a recent NATO summit.
Exactly. But this is what I talk about when I talk about fishhook theory. Like, the quote-unquote center will break for the right if forced to choose between the left and the right. And it doesn't take a real socialist. It could be a social democrat who just threatens
right.
their
That's exactly.
financial interests. And it's not just voting. It's when you talk about people with this much money and power, you know, they make donations, they use their outsized platforms and all of that stuff.
There's no doubt in my mind. I think, you know, to the extent that anything can be done about it now, it is to nip this meme in the bud, as it were, right? Like, because Donnie Deutsch is out there saying this. Part of it is so that it becomes a talking point as to why you got to vote against Bernie Sanders in the primary, because as if, like, there's an inevitable there's an inevitable chance that people are going to abandon the party because of Bernie Sanders. And it's not inevitable. It's simply the choice that Donnie Deutsch is trying to make. No one's forcing him to do that. So,
well, here's a hot take. Maybe if he's willing to abandon the party over mild social democratic reforms, the party shouldn't have him. Like, if we want to realign the Democratic Party to be more of a labor party, more of a left formation, like, the interests of the bosses conflict with the interests of the workers, right? And there's some good faith bosses who are welcome to come along.
Yes, but
and
I'm,
there's some bad
how
faith
does,
ones.
How does the party say we don't want Donnie Deutsch? Like, the party can't kick him out. He's just a guy going on there speaking who would be presumably, I mean, so yes, I don't care about Donnie Deutsch being a member of the Democratic Party. He has no influence on the Democratic Party. He does have an influence with a platform every day on the media where he's arguing that there's going to be a backlash if you nominate. And he's basically arguing the same thing that Howard Schultz is arguing. And the reason why they're arguing this now is not because he's going to do in the voting booth. The reason why he's arguing this right now is to on the ledger of why you would vote for or against a candidate to put this on the ledger. So that's why at this point, there's nobody in the Democratic Party who comes out and says, Donnie Deutsch is not a member of the Democratic Party. It doesn't matter.
I officially evict you.
Yeah, it's the point is that now is the time, and good for Joe Scarborough. He did exactly what should be done in that instance, and I'm surprised because he's a Republican. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, Digby will be joining us. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Ladies and gentlemen, from the Uber blog Hullabaloo, the subject of this little ditty. Oh, and here we go. What? This little ditty. We, Digby, there we go. I thought that was going somewhere else. I don't know what's going to happen to me this week. It's been a little bit rough with me and music. Hello, Digby. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
Oh, I guess I see what's going on there. Someone just sent me an exchange between Casey Hunt, and I want to talk obviously about the, you know, maybe we can touch a little bit about New Zealand. Like I you know, I don't know what there is to say about these type of attacks. I mean, we have an environment in the U.S. and obviously, you know, when a guy, you know, with the internet and a guy is citing Candace Owens, you know, whether we don't know in what context he's citing her as some type of inspiration. But obviously, American culture impacts this guy, this Australian in New Zealand, when he goes in to shoots up this mosque. You know, we have a president who, and frankly, I mean, you know, the research says that the presidency of Barack Obama, you know, ignited some of the feelings of racist, frankly, and that Trump has fanned those flames. I don't know. I mean, what is there to say at this point? We know the context in which these, you know, lunatics out there who have access to these type of weapons are bathed in. And, you know, like anything, it seems to me, it's all about increasing percentages of likelihood, right? Like there are people in society who pass a certain threshold of craziness. And when you have, a context in society, in an environment in society that feeds those people who pass a certain threshold, this is what you get.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt, and it's very, you know, it's coincidental, but extremely interesting that this horrific mass murder took place, and it's a political murder, right? I mean, it's obvious that this guy was a you know, a frequenter of 8chan and all these, you know, far right sort of communities online, where his manifesto, it's filled with all what they call shit posting, right? Which is just this, it's provocative. It's designed to get a rise, and it's all very ironic, and it kind of speaks in code. And that's part of the Candace Owens thing. I mean, evidently, I read this analysis by Bellingcat, you know, who does sort of follows all this internet stuff, and saying that the far right internet stuff, and it's a interesting to me how much that tracks with what we understand to have been the foreign interference in the election and the ongoing sort of propaganda campaign online by the Russians. It's this idea of creating chaos, right? This just making everybody start infighting and everything. And that was part of apparently what the point of the manifesto was, you know, using this sort of ironic trolling to get people upset, and the Candace Owens thing was part of that. But at the same time, you had the president just yesterday being reported to have said that, you know, well, you know, my people, my military, my cops, and you know, the what was it? The
I've got it right here. This is in Breitbart. This is in Breitbart, and this is what he said. You know, the left plays a tougher game. It's very funny. I actually think that the people on the right are tougher, but they don't play it tougher. Okay, I can tell you I have the support of the police, the support of the military, the support of the bikers for Trump. I have the tough people, but they don't play it tough until they go to a certain point. And then it would be very bad, very bad. But the left plays it cuter and tougher. In other words, he's basically saying like, God, I can't, you know, I have these people, they're on my side. I can't totally control them because it would be bad if they did bad stuff. I mean, that's basically what he's saying.
Well, and it was proved, right? I mean, I think this guy in New Zealand, I mean, he's not even an American, but this is a global movement. And they all seem to really love Trump. I mean, he said it in that he considered him to be an icon or an inspiration or something. That Trump was actually saying that. Look, you know, I can't control these guys. You know, if you don't do what we need, I can't. What can I say? They're going to do what they're going to do. And basically, yesterday in New Zealand, somebody did that. They actually went out and started shooting Muslims. You know, and Trump hasn't been. He's been sort of focusing on the Latinos lately. But you know, he's got a long history of Muslim hating as well. So you know, that it fits in perfectly. And I mean, this is sort of to me, when I saw the New Zealand thing, I was up late last night when the story broke. I was, you know, that was the first thing that came to my mind. I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, this is the president. He's basically giving a green light to this kind of stuff. And he basically did that. And it's weird that I don't even think that it made much of a ripple where, you know, people talk about normalization.
Right.
Well, apparently Trump's, you know, fascist impulses are now normal. And he's, and everybody's just going, well, there he goes again. Well, yeah, people are going to take him at his word. And I just think, look, and we've had this here. We had the guy sending out, you know, the bombs to members of the media and members of Congress. I mean, the bombs turned out to be duds, but what if they hadn't? They just arrested a guy a couple weeks ago there in Washington. It was in the same kind of community as this guy in New Zealand. So this stuff is happening, and I don't know, you know, are we going to take it seriously, or are we just going to act like, oh, gee, you know, another lone wolf? You know?
Right. Well, I mean, we know that as far as the Homeland Security is concerned, like, these type of ilk of people are considered one of the, you know, the greatest sort of in domestic terror threat that we face. And there is really, I mean, there's been rollback after rollback in terms of dealing with these type of folks. And I don't know. I mean, I don't believe that Donald Trump has the military and has the cops, right? Maybe he has bikers for Trump to the extent that they're, but it is highly problematic that he's calling for it. And certainly when he makes those claims and sort of divvies stuff up, like, I mean, just it is to step back and to contemplate the idea that a U.S. president would be arguing that the military's behind him.
Yeah.
You know, like, against whom? Like, you know, like the idea that the cops are behind me. He's not talking about elections. And, you know, it's Trump. And so we don't take him seriously, right? Like, he's a buffoon. But the idea that the president of the United States would be sort of divvying stuff up like this, like you say, you and I mean, I don't know. You and I, you know, are a little bit maybe less concerned about this, or maybe concern's not the right word. Don't think that he has a grip on exactly, you know, who supports him in what case. But for folks who are more mentally estranged, let's say, that type of thing is a call to arms. Whose side are you going to be on? There's a civil war coming.
Yeah, exactly.
Whose side are you going to be on?
And I keep hearing from people who sort of follow this stuff that, you know, this is a very live discussion on sort of right-wing, you know, gun-toting, gun rights kind of places, where they are really believing that there's a civil war coming. I mean, this is becoming, you know, and I'm thinking of a specific person that I know who's very tied into that community who says that, you know, it's different than it was before. You know, there's always been this kind of, you know, weekend warrior thing that they all, you know, run around in their camo and do their militia thing. That's been out there forever in American culture, but there's something different now. This idea that there's sort of being that there's this movement, and some of it's crazy, you know, that the QAnon and all that stuff. But there's also this sort of sense among these people that something's brewing. They're getting excited, and whether or not anything would happen, I mean, I agree with you that I sincerely doubt that the military as an institution is going to, you know, suddenly take up arms on behalf of Donald Trump. I mean, that's just not realistic. And cops, you know, there are probably some cops who, you know, are big. We know that there are some that are big Trump fans. They run around with wearing the red hats and doing the whole thing. But as, you know, as a group, I don't know that we could, you know, assume that they're going to take up arms for Donald Trump either. Bikers for Trump, maybe, but, you know, whatever. But, you know, this idea that there are members of those institutions that are for Trump. Yeah, that's the truth. I mean, you know, the Oath Keepers, which is a real group, they are made up of veterans, military people in the military, and police officers. That's the population of the Oath Keepers. And so, you know, this does exist out there, and it's just, you know, it's a little unnerving, the idea that, you know, we're sort of letting, you know, the president just makes, you know, casual fascist remarks. Casually says it to, you know, and then apparently he posted a link to Breitbart last night, which was later taken down, although it's unsure whether or not he meant it to go to that particular quote, but that, you know, he probably meant it to go to the article it was in. And they took down the tweet. But, you know, this is very, very unnerving to me. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm overreacting, you know, because he is a buffoon and everybody's kind of going, yeah, yeah. And there's a lot of this. See, have you noticed this sort of theme that's sort of emerging that, well, Trump's a really weak president because he doesn't really know what he's doing. So we really needn't fear what he's saying and all this stuff because it's just him and he's not that great at fulfilling his fascistic goals or whatever. And I think is ridiculous. I mean, he's saying this stuff, he's normalizing it. I mean, maybe he won't accomplish it, but damn, somebody.
Exactly. I think that is exactly the most important point is that everybody presumes like, oh, if Donald Trump doesn't have the military on his side, then we have nothing to worry about. But he is moving the ball along. I mean, this is, you know, I'm already worried about 2028, frankly, or 2024. And regardless of, you know, and I'm presuming that a Democratic candidate is going to win the presidency. At one point, like, you know, these people aren't going to go away. The problem is, are the people who support and voted for Donald Trump. And then the bigger problem is what, as a society, we now consider the baseline for appropriate behavior from our politicians. And if it starts at where Donald Trump leaves, right, and we've got to wait until the next person who comes in with Donald Trump's rhetoric, but maybe not Donald Trump's limited brain capacity, and somebody else who comes in there, and I don't know who it is, and maybe we know their name, and maybe we don't. We don't know yet. But there's a lot of people out there, if they're smart, are looking at what Trump has been able to accomplish, and they may have the same proclivities. And they come in, and next time we're going to be starting at a sort of like a basis point that is closer to, you know, what is fascism, right? Like, this is not a process that we can roll up and reverse in, you know, a couple of years, or expect it to only have a couple of years lifespan. Like, Donald Trump, in my mind, has always been part of a lineage that included Sarah Palin, that included aspects of the Bush administration. And when we didn't address these things then, when John McCain got a pass for elevating someone like Sarah Palin, when George Bush got a pass from President Obama and Nancy Pelosi, who's bragging about not impeaching people this week, about not impeaching, you know, the Bush administration, when they got a pass, they moved the ball forward for Donald Trump.
Oh, absolutely. Look, he's just, you know, this is a continuum. I mean, you and I have been watching this for years. The disintegration of the Republican Party and the conservative movement generally into its essence, which we now see, I think, in the form of Donald Trump. I mean, he's kind of, to me, he's like the, you know, the walking id of the conservative movement. And, you know, this is not something, he didn't spring forth overnight. And in fact, you know, we know this for a fact that, you know, Trump has some ideas in his head that he's had for a very long time. We know that he had trade and, you know, law and order. I mean, he's had certain things that he's kind of fixated on. But that, you know, the main, you know, sort of part of his program was lifted directly from talk radio. I mean, Sam Nunberg, who we've all seen run around on, you know, on MSNBC all over the place, and he's kind of a kooky guy. He worked with Roger Stone, and he would go and listen to talk radio, and he would put a report together for Trump. This started in 2012. He put a report together that sort of highlighted what they were talking about. You remember when Trump was on the trail and he was going on about Bo Bergdahl? You remember that? It was really weird. It was kind of like, what? Why do you care about this? But that is a perfect example of just a discrete issue that Nunberg picked up on that was all over the talk radio. And the interesting thing about the Bergdahl thing, and I wrote a lot about this at the time, was that what Trump was advocating when he was talking about on the campaign trail was summary execution. He felt that Bergdahl should have been shot immediately when they got him when they rescued him from the Taliban after he'd been held for, you know, a long period of time. They should have brought him out and immediately shot him. And he said this, you know, back in the day when we were strong, bing bong, you know, when we were strong, we would have taken care of him. And he used to pantomime, you know, shooting the guy with a rifle. So, you know, this was in the ether long before Trump came along. He sort of jumped on it and had this sort of unique, you know, spin on it, I guess, as the billion, you know, the blue collar billionaire, and how he was going to make every, you know, he's going to make everybody rich. You know, he had this sort of extra sort of thing, and the celebrity that he came with. But there's no way that this is that you can put this genie back in the bottle. It's been building for a long, long, long time. And I agree with you. I, you know, this isn't going away. And in fact, Trump himself is out there pretty much, and in the comment to Breitbart, was kind of indicating, hey, you know, I don't get reelected, I don't know what's going to happen, guys, because my people, you know, my
right.
people, they're not going to be happy. So, you know, could have a little problem here. Just telling you, you know, just but keep in mind that there could be a little problem.
I think that is going to be less of the problem than what comes back 4 years later or 8 years later, frankly. I mean, I we should say, you know, we talk about this lineage. I remember Mitt Romney coming to New York, kissing Donald Trump's hand in 2012, looking for the imprimatur. Like, you know, this did not come out of nowhere. And I think it was obviously a surprise that he won the election, but he won by a very small amount. And we had a very specific circumstance, I think, that allowed him. But even if he was to lose by, you know, a landslide this time around, there's still going to be 40 some odd of the percent of the country who are highly amenable to this message. And we have clearly seen that to the extent that there ever was a structure of the Republican Party that would be a firewall for this type of thing, there is no
right.
firewall. And,
right.
you know, it is one thing for them to push back on this emergency measure, you know, which I don't know that they're going to have the votes to reverse a veto, but they have not stood up to him, and one can only imagine how completely useless they would be with a president who uses these tactics but has a modicum of intelligence in dealing with right. Like, I mean, it's not like
right.
Donald Trump has sophisticated, knowledgeable people around him as to the to the motive incentive structure of Republican legislators beyond the fact that they all support me and my agenda, which is, you know, more or less racism at this point and misogyny and anti-immigration fervor, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, it's a pretty dangerous situation, and people should not be mistaken into thinking that when Donald Trump gets, defeated, if hopefully, but it will be the case, if he gets defeated and then Robert Mueller walks up and personally puts handcuffs on him and makes him do a perp walk to the federal courthouse in Washington on that same day, this is not over by a long shot, right? And the real question is, and this is maybe a good segue, is like, you know, aside from, I mean, you know, from it, there are a lot of responses that have to happen within the context of society to this type of what we're experiencing in this country. One of them is going to be obviously the Democrats and you know, the potential for them to win in 2020. The field, for the most part, now seems to be, I mean, Joe Biden hasn't made it official yet, has he? But he will, right? Or did he make it official? I don't even know. I mean, it just seems so obvious.
I don't think he has yet.
But it sounds like we've heard the unofficial official announcement. But maybe, you know, who knows?
He's in.
And for the most part, I think we're not waiting for any more major players to jump in. You know, there could be sleeper candidates and this and that. But, I mean, there's nobody, aside from Joe Biden, there's nobody on the sidelines that everybody's anticipating coming in and anticipating impacting the race on day one. Beto announced yesterday, I guess it was, And he's a big force, despite the fact that he's, you know, he's a backbench congressman, because he's got the second biggest fundraising apparatus of anybody in the race at this point. He's also got some very strong sort of grassroots organizers that came out of the Bernie campaign. I'm thinking of Becky Bond and others. This guy captured the imagination of the Democratic Party in his run against Ted Cruz. What's your take, Digby?
Well, I'm probably more sympathetic to Beto than a lot of other progressives like myself are, and I'll tell you why. But let me first just sort of come out there and say that, you know, my dream president out of this crew that we have running right now, I mean, I like them all fine. You know, I mean, compared to Donald Trump, any of them would be fine, and I'm not going to be unhappy particularly. I mean, well, Howard Schultz, of course, is completely out of the question. But, you know, and if Bloomberg were in, I couldn't go there. But even Biden, who I really, you know, he's not my choice. If it happened, you know, I could live with it. So, but if I were to pick my dream president out of this group right now, it would be Elizabeth Warren. She aligns with me on virtually everything, you know, politically, but I'm not endorsing anybody or anything right now, and then that includes Beto or whatever. However, I do understand why Beto has an appeal, and why on some levels he appeals to me too, and that is because he has a very different approach than most Democrats do to talking about politics, and it's compelling because he speaks from a sort of value standpoint. He's not a programmatic guy. And, you know, I know that for a lot of Democrats, that's a real problem because that's what they like to hear. I happen to understand why a lot of people don't like to hear that they're much more interested in saying, you know, what do you care about? How do you, you know, who are you fighting for? You know, sort of this kind of what do you see? What do you think America is about? What is it? You know, and he's good at that. He has a good, I've heard him give a number of speeches. And I actually followed him back in 2012 when he first ran against, he actually defeated a Democrat in a primary, which is how he very unexpectedly won. It was an upset, who was Silvestre Reyes, who was a very right-wing Democrat. And he sort of went around knocking on doors in the Hispanic community and basically won, you know, in spite of, you know, all the predictions. So there, he has something, and he has something that I think is sort of an inspirational message that can be, you know, Democrats tend to do well when they have candidates who can do that. You know, Obama, Clinton, JFK, you know, even Jimmy Carter back in the 70s had those, you know, this kind of, I'm speaking to a bigger, you know, a bigger sense of who we are, and Democrats do respond to that. Having said all that, I have no idea, you know, how he's going to do. He has a spotty record in the Congress of being probably too conservative for the current Democratic Party the primary electorate. So whether or not, you know, I mean, let the games begin. That's how I look at it. And whoever can, you know, they've got a long time to prove themselves here. It's an exhausting road ahead of us on this primary. It's probably going to get very unpleasant in many ways. So, you know, but I'm willing to let this unfold and see how these people do. And hopefully, whoever it is will take some of the best from all these people. I mean, they've all got something to offer. And at the end of the day, hopefully whoever that is will have put together an amalgam of where the Democratic Party is to go forward into the general election and go up against Donald Trump. I mean, I'm hopeful that it will be a good progressive agenda and, you know, somebody with some, you know, fire in the belly to actually kind of confront all this stuff. And that may be one of the Beto's biggest weaknesses, in my view, is the fact that he does not seem to be the kind of person. I mean, that's why I like Elizabeth Warren. You know, she's a fighter, and she's just kind of, no, I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to stand down here. You know, forget it. No, we're not going to do that. We're going to go up against, and we're going to fight and win. And I don't see that with him. You know, he's a conciliator. So, you know, in that sense, I think he may be very much out of step. But maybe the Democratic electorate doesn't see it that way.
Right.
They, you know, they're going to respond more. So, anyway, I know I sound like a, you know, a bucket of lukewarm water here, but that's kind of where I am at the moment on this.
Well,
on this,
but I think that assessment of where he's at is super accurate, and it really does. It's going to be interesting to see, you know, what the Democratic Party is interested in, and of course, we won't even have that full notion either because you have so many candidates, right? Like this is like one of those races where strange things could happen because there's so the threshold to winning is going to be lower in some respects, right? I mean, at least throughout three quarters of the race because of how many people are in it. There was a piece that came out today in the and it's always sort of fascinating, like the day that, you know, this is a piece obviously that was written a week ago and with information that was supplied 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago by somebody else's campaign. We don't know whose campaign it would be. But this was in the Wall Street Journal that O'Rourke, in the run-up to that 2012 campaign where he defeated Sylvester Reyes, he filled out, here it is, in a candidate questionnaire published 2 days before the 2012 primary, O'Rourke called for raising the Social Security eligibility age, means testing federal entitlements, criticized Reyes for voting party line with other Democrats, asked if he supported the Affordable Care Act. He said in its current form, no, it doesn't do anything for El Paso in terms of the Medicaid reimbursement rate. But he added that he was supportive of all the aims of the law. So, you know, who knows? I mean, it's going to be interesting. And I read that Vanity Fair piece and I was like, I so much want to support this guy. But when we got to the section about the politics, it was fascinating. There was no politics there. And in many respects, it is reminiscent of Obama a little bit, although, you know, the war was a big deal. The fact that he ran again, you know, that he was able to run against the Iraq war, that was a big deal. It's unclear to me what Beto's signature. Well, I think it's, you know, it's climate change.
It's the border. I think it's the border. I think that's Beto's big. It's immigration, I think, is his signature.
Interesting. And it's going to be interesting to see if there's an appetite for that amongst the Democrats. I mean, I see a guy like that, and I worry that in the wrong context, his politics could be, I mean, they could widely diverge, it seems to me. I feel like Obama entered the race. He was not ideological. He was much more about, very similar to Beto, like, I want to bring people together. But he did seem to have some politics. And even people whose politics I don't like as they're articulated in the race, I feel like that's what we're going to get on some level. Like, I'm not clear what somebody coming in who thinks that they can negotiate with Republicans, what we're going to get with that person, because they're going to find out at one point that they can't, right?
Grand bargains.
Well, right. I mean, and which is really sort of scary. And who knows? Maybe this time the Republican Party will be smart enough to say yes on these grand bargains, but who knows? It's definitely going to be fascinating to watch this. And then the other thing that I think is fascinating, we played this clip before we had you on this morning, where Donnie Deutsch was on Joe Scarborough saying that he was prepared to vote for Donald Trump over, I guess, presumably over Bernie Sanders. And Scarborough literally had to say, don't say that. Stop yourself. And convinced Donnie Deutsch on air not to say that, for the sake of Donnie Deutsch's career, basically, it seems like, in the branding of the show. But I think that's a very real potential dynamic that the Donnie Deutsches are gonna go the way of Howard Schultz. Or at the very least, they're going to threaten that over the next couple of months as a way of, you know, sort of scaring people away from Bernie. I mean, do you think at the end of the day, where do you think at the end of the day these people would go?
I don't think so. I mean, I have to assume Donnie Deutsch, you know, I mean, I think he's kind of a blowhard anyway. But,
well, yes.
You know, this is even beyond what I would expect from him. Obviously, what he's trying to do is position, you know, himself as being sort of the guy, the practical, sort of centrist, regular Democrat, and trying to warn people, you know, hey, you nominate Sanders, and I assume Warren's in that too. She doesn't call herself a socialist, but I'm sure. But all the Wall Street people are having a fit over her. They're absolutely doing, you know, exploding over what she her proposals, her highly detailed proposals that are going to affect their business. They're all saying that, you know, they're saying, hey, you know, you vote for one of these, and I don't know, maybe I'm going to have to give some money to Trump. Maybe I'm going to have to vote for him. And it's basically just a threat. And, it, you know, it's a Trump-like threat, to be honest, saying, you do this, I don't know which way I'm going to go. And they're also speaking to another group that is, you know, kind of important for the Democrats to kind of keep in the back of their mind. A lot of the people who voted in 2018 for some of these new, you know, that flipped some of these seats, were in formerly Republican suburbs. And so they're trying to scare those people, you know, saying, hey, you know, maybe Trump's, you know, maybe these people are going too far. They're doing their own Trump thing on the left. So maybe, you know, at least Trump, we know what we got with this guy, right?
Right.
And so they're trying to kind of scare people that those people aren't going to vote for the Democrat, too. I don't think that, I think Trump is bad enough that most people are going to hold their nose and vote for whoever the Democrat is, even if they've been propagandized by Donny Deutsch. I mean, why we're listening to him anyway, I don't know. But this is something that's, you know, I assume Deutsch is a Biden guy. I don't know why I haven't heard him say that necessarily, but I just expect that Biden is the general choice of that particular group. It's going to be very interesting to see how this all, you know, they all talk about lanes, which I hate. It was a 2016 trope that they came up with. But, you know, Biden is going to be the establishment guy. And, you know, everybody's sort of thinking that, and I expect that somebody like Deutsch will be happy to back, you know, the good, you know, predictable Joe Biden. That's somebody that they're sort of, oh, good, maybe we can get back to normal now. Biden looks like a president. He's the guy I really want. So, you know, I assume that that's where that this fight is going to be had on that basis. Like I said, this is going to be unpleasant. I hope everybody, you know, gird yourself, because this isn't going to be a lot of fun. We're going to be
fighting. No, this is going to be super nasty. I mean, give me your sense and I'm just looking at this. It was funny. This is going to be interesting. Casey Hunt asked Nancy Pelosi, do you think that experience in terms of Beto O'Rourke has here in the House is a strong enough foundation to jump to the Oval Office? And Pelosi was like, you asked me that when we have a president of the United States who, you know, well, please. Yes. The answer is yes. I mean, she got halfway through that, where she was basically like, we can't have a less experienced, less capable, less prepared president than Donald Trump. And I think that's true. What do you think of Joe Biden? I mean, give me a sense of, like, what do you think is going to happen with Joe Biden? I know, like, you know, we've all learned enough to, you know, keep our predictions, as unambitious as possible. But where do you think Joe Biden's, what do you think his chances are?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, looking at it from the perspective of you know, the modern Democratic Party where we are right now, there are just so many aspects of his past. There's so much baggage with Biden that, you know, it's hard for me to see how he can, you know, gain enough of the party to, you know, actually become the nominee. I mean, I would expect there's a certain, you know, like the Donny Deutsch people, the sort of, they're just looking for some reassurance that we're going to go back to normal, we'll get a normal, you know, mainstream Democrat guy, we know him, good old Uncle Joe, we know who he is, and then we can just get back on track. And I think people like you know, like you and me, you know, we sort of see that something's really fundamentally changed. We're in a new world now, and we're not going to go back to what used to be normal, regardless of you know, whether or not the Democrats take over, for some of the reasons we talked about earlier, that the Republican Party is now a radical faction. You know, basically, and also that the Democrats have changed. I mean, this is a new day in the Democratic Party as well, and there's actually, you know, opportunity to kind of push forward with a new agenda. And Biden is just not, you know, he just does not fit into that. On the other hand, you know, there are a lot of Democrats in this country who are, you know, they're very, you know, mainstream kind of, you know, regular people who may not be on board with that. And I honestly don't know. I mean, we're going to find out
where
this party really is. We're going to find out over the next year just, to, you know, where we're going with that.
It is a little bit nerve-wracking because it's not, in my mind, it's not just a question of going backwards, although I think that is, you know, exactly. Like, people would like to reset it to a different time where we didn't have to sort of pay attention to politics. God knows I would. and maybe that was a delusion, and I'm quite sure in many respects it was. But the problem with going back too is that, to the extent that there is, you know, wide support out there for Biden, it seems to me it's going to be two parts, right? One is going to be just sort of people in the know who are convinced we need to have someone to win. They're convinced that it's going to take an old white guy to defeat Donald Trump. I'm not sure what the logic is behind that. Maybe that's, you know, there's basically two scenarios where the Democrats take the presidency that people are talking about. They're not necessarily mutually exclusive, although they could be seen that way. One is through the post-industrial Midwest, where you go back and you win Pennsylvania, you win Wisconsin, you win Michigan, and those three states make it happen from 2016. Or you end up, you know, going the Southwest and you take a bunch of states there that, you know, are on the cusp of turning blue. They're not mutually exclusive propositions, although, you know, certainly one candidate might be the profile of one candidate might be more applicable to one of the others. But one concern I have is we, you know, to just end this conversation in many respects where we started it, is without the Democrats moving forward with some type of an agenda that represents, you know, a fairly substantial change from the past. And I feel like, you know, frankly, Warren and Sanders, in many respects, from a programmatic standpoint, are the only ones who offer that type of thing. We run the risk of, you know, sort of a similar sort of frustration bubbling up again. And that type of frustration, I think, is much more susceptible to being exploited by a smarter version of Donald Trump. And like, there needs to be, to the extent, you know, Beto's argument is the way that we get out of this is by just coming together. And I find that hard to believe that that happens that way. I think the way that we get out of this, it seems to me, is to change the paradigm in such that the current narrative from the right is really hard to sustain. I think we're always going to have, not always, but I think we're going to have 30-40% of this country that are going to be ass backwards, frankly. You know, like dug in ass backwards. But the dynamic has to be such that they're just less motivated in some way. And, you know, are kept busy in other ways, I guess. I'm not sure. There needs to be a paradigm shift, it seems to me. Just the
maybe
idea.
Maybe chastened. What? Just a little bit chastened. Maybe they just have to sort of recognize that they, you know, that they're not going to prevail.
Well,
that the country is not where they are.
Yeah, I don't think they're, see, the thing, I don't think they're ever going to, they're ever going to change their perspective. I mean, I think it's going to take generations. I just think that the ability to weaponize those people by more powerful forces has to be undercut. And that may involve just undercutting those more powerful forces, right? Like, you know, and that being that you need to sort of, in many respects, kneecap the moneyed interests that weaponize these people. And rather than trying to, you know, change those people, because I think there's mounting evidence that, like, you know, we interviewed somebody on this program over vacation who basically could track racism as practiced through politics based upon down to the county level
on what the ratio of slaves to the black slaves to white people were. And if you can do that 200 some odd years later,
yep.
180 years later, I'm sorry, we've got a couple more generations to go, right?
Yeah, and it's true. And maybe it's just, you know, an intrinsic sort of built into our system. I mean, I've often thought that, you know, we were born, this country was born on the back of this tremendous divide. It happened, it was there from the very beginning, and it's consistent. We even had a civil war. It didn't fix it.
Yep.
You know, I mean, so, you know, this is not, but it does not have to be this toxic, and it doesn't have to be this dangerous. I mean, this divide will exist. It just, there's got to be, and we have had those periods where we were reasonably able to live side by side.
Well, and when you think about those periods, I mean, to the extent that, I think when some of those periods were periods where, frankly, we still were basically living with, multiple series of subclass citizenry, right? Where people mm-hmm. were second class citizens, third
right.
class citizens.
Well, that's true, yeah.
But to the extent that there was, you know, some type of equilibrium, it was when money, essentially, big money was restricted. Yep. And so the real question is, like, you know, do we have a programmatic, you know, and I think, like, you know, Sanders, like you say, and Warren represent a threat to these powerful classes that weaponize this divide in these people. And that is why I think, like, I worry about a presidency that doesn't kneecap those people who have an outsized political power in our society and use that divide to their advantage, it seems to me. But we'll have more time to talk about this, Digby, and it's going to get a lot messier. As always, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me. Have a great weekend, Sam.
You too, Digby. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Check it out, folks. You can read Heather's stuff at Solanda. We didn't even get to the story that she did on the potential for this sort of Chinese scandal. That there seems to be a little bit more there, coming out of these day spas than we might have anticipated. But who knows? And but we will have Digby back. You can check out her writing at salon.com or on her blog at Hullabaloo. We've got to take a quick break. When we come back, Matthew, film guy. Just a reminder, folks, this program relies on your support. You can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support this show for just pennies a day, but you also get extra content every day. We'll be right back. Matthew Film Guy.
It's just a bad movie where there's no crying. Handing the keys to me in this red line where the lock that you locked in the sweet says there's no prying. When the breath that you breathe in the street screams there's no science. When you look how you look then to me that I cease lying and fall into silence. So there's no climax, no more new territory. So pull away your max. In the slot that you sliced through the scene, there was no shyness. In the plot that you passed through.
We are back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, it is that time on a casual Friday where we will seek out. I mean, this is how this segment actually started, was back in the day when I would look for a film recommendation for the weekend from someone who I thought was ostensibly a film critic. It turned out he was just an entertainment reporter and denied being a film critic after literally, I think, a year or two on the program. That was a little bit upsetting. So we jettisoned that guy. Nice guy, but still, you can't come on and...
Can't lie about your credentials.
So instead, what we did is we got a professor from the accredited JCC Learning Annex course in Queens to come on, and thus inspiring this song. Matthew, film guy.
Let it play out. And then a pregnant
pause. That is correct.
Pause.
Listen to the lyrics. It tells you all you need to know.
All you need to know. Matthew, film guy.
We could have worked in something there. We could have worked in something there about the Learning Annex class, but probably would have extended the running time. So you just have to fill us in on that each week.
Now, you're not technically a professor, right? I mean...
Well, yeah, when I teach at Sacred Heart University and their graduate... film program I am. I mean, it's an adjunct or whatever. It's not like I'm tenured or something, but yeah.
Wow, is that right? I didn't realize. I mean, so what? How does your are you doing that, or is that you just was that a hypothetical?
No, I'm not doing it. I aspire someday to do that.
Oh.
No, I'm doing that. Of course I'm doing that. Well, actually, I didn't do it this year because, as you know, I was on the road for 6 weeks, but for the past 4 years.
So how does your class at the Learning Annex differ from your class at, what is it, Sacred Heart, did you say?
Yeah, I actually was teaching editing, the art of film editing at Sacred Heart University.
Oh.
Being one of my specialties.
So you were
and
editing.
And then at the Learning Annex class, it's just general film appreciation, showing our films to senior citizens with,
you know what I thought of,
higher than usual curiosity.
So, wait a second.
Can film by Matthew hear me?
Yeah, hold on for one second. Okay. So wait a second. So you weren't actually teaching film; you were teaching editing.
I'm sorry, Sam. Maybe you're under the mistaken impression, but editing is film.
It is.
Yes, there is no film without editing. It is the one pure form of expression that is unique to film.
There is no
writing,
well, wait
like
a second.
Literature.
You're making
you
a category
acting,
at
like
it.
Drama.
Right. There is no Labrador Retriever that isn't a dog, but there are dogs that aren't Labrador Retrievers. You can learn the skill of editing and not necessarily apply it to film. And I don't mean just the medium. I'm talking about the sort of the narrative structure. I mean, let's be honest. People could be taking that video class, and all they could do is end up coming and doing, like, I'm going to put some B-roll in over Sam talking about, you know, Beto O'Rourke.
Don't confuse the technical side of things, which is actually 50% of what I do teach at the Sacred Heart University graduate film program, with the understanding of how to use the aesthetics of film editing. But, I mean, you obviously have a point of view. You're flogging here, and I don't want to argue with you. It's your show, and I'll just agree to disagree.
Okay. I'm a little sensitive because I just remembered the way that, in your intro, it just came up. I recalled the moment when I learned that our film critic was actually,
yes,
you know, not a film critic.
Yes, you've been burned before, Sam. I'm going to be very sensitive
right
about that, yeah.
Once something, twice shy. I can't remember.
Sorry.
Once burned, twice shy.
Once bitten.
Once bitten, twice shy. I'm sorry, Michael. Did you wanted to question further on that?
No, it's fine. I think we moved past that. I was thinking of because everything. Partially, I'm tired, but now because I'm rewatching The Sopranos, everything is a Sopranos reference in my mind right now. So I need to stop watching that show as quickly as possible. But when I thought of Film Guy Matthew with his nice elderly Jewish students, I thought of Polly Walnuts taking his mom and her friends out
from the
retirement home to go watch a play. And then, yeah. Anyways, I'm not going to go on from there because I'll just start repeating the show. But that is now how I see Matthew as an intellectual version of Polly Walnuts being like, Ma, it's a German film. It's about incest, but it's really about capitalism. Come on.
So now, wait,
the ladies will love it.
So, all right. So with all that said, I mean,
dead on.
What is the similarity between the editing class that you teach and the one at the JCC?
Well, obviously, the one at the JCC is much more expansive. It takes in all aspects of the film experience, and it's more designed to broaden the kind of aesthetic and, you know, kind of artistic sensibilities of the class. Whereas the editing class, you know, I do couch it in a kind of broader context of various film theories and the kind of language of film. But also we're talking about, you know, accomplishing a very specific technical goal as well. So, you know, one is a deeper and more narrow dive, but they have a lot of overlap. You know, I have my own personal theory of what makes a film good. I try to editorialize less in the actual editing class because I am trying to impart a skill that they can use to go ahead and get a job or make a film or just be empowered to make their own kind of craft. But, you know, they What's the commonality? Me, Sam. Matthew, the film guy. I am the commonality.
Well, all right. There you go.
That's very Beto O'Rourke.
You know, you got it. Yeah. You can't teach art objectively. You know, you kind of have to give it your personal attention. And I try to give my, you know, my enthusiasm for the art form in every lesson. And hopefully, you know, the best you can do is inspire someone to pursue their own path when it comes to art. They're not going to do it exactly the way you did it or somebody else did it. It's a fool's errand to try to reverse engineer art and try to just figure out how someone else did it. You kind of have to give them a few basic skills and then the belief that they can do it.
Well, I guess it's just going to be a matter of time if some other JCC comes around and tries to poach you based upon wanting to have Matthew Film Guy at their JCC to compete with the Learning Annex in Queens.
Oh yeah, I got various JCCs playing against each other right now as we speak. It's a whole system I've worked out. Yeah.
I teach the old ladies Danish anti-consumerist incense cinema here. You stay the fuck out of Queens.
Yeah,
is there a lot of competition amongst the Learning Annex film teachers?
Oh, I am in high demand.
No, but I mean, honest, I'm just saying, like, when you come and try and infiltrate, let's say, you know, Western Long Island,
right.
JCC.
I know him. That's Paul Ginsberg. He dropped out of Tisch.
Yeah, why is
one credit shy? He's been trying to move into the Long Island market for years now.
You're supposed to stay on the North Shore. What are you doing here?
Please excuse me.
You take your DOS boat and go back to New Jersey with it.
You know nothing.
If
the
Matthew
cinema,
Film Guy, let's put it this way: if you were to have a conflict that could devolve into physical conflict with another Learning Annex film teacher, over what genre of film would it be? Like, what would you find so offensive that you were forced to actually get physical?
I'm not sure I completely follow the question, but if
well, in other words, like
let's
say there was a hypothetical teacher who was a film guy who was coming from a different part of Long Island to come into Queens to teach at the Learning Annex. However, they embraced, let's say, I don't know, a more naturalistic style of filmmaking than you did, or just for an example. Oh, I know that's actually not the case.
You're trying to piss them off right now?
What's that? Well, but I'm just suggesting, I understand you would be the guy in that scenario who would support the naturalistic style of filmmaking. What would they support?
Who's coming in? Who's coming into my territory, Sam? What are you talking about?
I'm just asking a hypothetical.
Do you know somebody that's trying to?
I don't want to make you paranoid. I'm just asking a hypothetical. There's a lot of talk.
Oh, God, Sam. Come on, Sam. I thought you had my back on this. Okay, I'll answer your silly question. The silly answer is, if somebody wanted to come out and say, I understand John Cassavetes better than you, Matthew Film Guy, then I would have to throw down.
Okay. All right. There you go.
Like, I told you, I studied Cassavetes. You don't know a fucking thing about Cassavetes. And then Sam's pulling him off. He's like, hey, Sam, I got a right to defend myself.
Did you hear what he fucking said?
So, all right. So with that said, I don't know how we got on this.
It's actually really not a bad character.
I think honestly, it's because you and Michael are both very tired at the end of a long week, and it's the perfect time for just concentrate a little bit on some self-care, a little bit of casual Friday, step away from the politics battle, the knife fight, and have some, a moment of kind of reflection on everything that's important.
Why do I feel like that is a sort of a prologue to your
door-to-door vacuum salesman pitch right there for the Danish?
Can I interest you in the XJ7 cinema experience?
No. What do you have for us this week?
Well, to be honest, that's the setup for every week. Like, I feel like that's what I'm supposed to do here. I think that's what's needed on this show, is just a little bit of a step back from the sort of the trenches, and to go a little bit more wide view.
I could
talk about some of the films that I've been showing in my class. Like, you know, actually, for me personally, there's always going to be, no matter how big a film guy you are, there's always going to be some dark areas in your experience. And I've been trying to fill in some of the gaps. And I've been getting into Hirokazu Koreeda. I don't know if anybody is a fan of his film, the Japanese filmmaker who's really been making world-class films for over 20, maybe even 30 years. I'm starting at the beginning with him, and I showed his film Mabarossi, which is sort of an homage to Ozu, another filmmaker who I love, a Japanese filmmaker from post-war Japan. And that was great. I could also maybe talk about another filmmaker who I'm in love with, aesthetically speaking, named Lucrecia Martel. She's from Argentina, and she's only managed to make 4 movies so far, but the 2 of them that I've seen have both blown me away. I think I may have mentioned one in passing called La Cienega, about a kind of idle kind of rich class in Argentina. And the one I recently showed my class is called The Holy Girl, which is kind of hard to explain, but it's basically about a teenage girl who lives at her family's hotel, and a dental convention comes in, and she may or may not have been molested by one of the dentists. I'm sorry, the eyes, ears, and throat doctor. But it's told in a very kind of even-handed, not editorialized style, very nuanced, and it's really just a gut punch of a film. But you know what, Sam? I'm gonna detail this week's suggestion. Yeah.
If she's so good, why don't she make more movies?
Well, obviously the patriarchy gets in her way.
4 is not a lot.
No, it's not a lot. But you know what? Quality is important more than quantity, I think. And she's only been making movies since 2001. So, you know, we'll see. Right. Actually, people have floated her name as someone who should direct a superhero movie. But that's more of a...
That's
story.
Kind of the
sure
new thing, right? Is to get like actual like good.
Is that the only
of...
reason why people go into film now? Is to do some work that gets them in a position to do a superhero movie?
But that's
well,
the
that's
new thing.
Like
we
want to
instead of hiring like I forget the guy's name, but like some blockbuster idiot. The new thing is like, oh, he made a movie about like an old couple dying together in the south of France. He should make the new Marvel movie.
Yeah.
Like people say,
give him Wolverine. That is kind of what they've been doing, but that's not the only movies that are being made. That's just the ones that
they are a little bit better, actually.
Megaplexes.
I could say. Yeah, well, I mean, look, movies cost a lot of money, right? And decisions seem to be made mainly based on money rather than artistic choices in the big budget movies, wouldn't you say?
In Hollywood, absolutely, no doubt.
I think that sucks. I mean, people think communist art is bad, but like, look at all the crap in the cinemas. Like, that's the art of capitalism. Enjoy.
Absolutely. No doubt about that. But you have to remember that there is more film out there besides what comes out of Hollywood. There's the American independent scene, and there's also the international film scene with actually a lot more public support than anything in America gets. So that's why someone like Corey Ada or Lucrecia Martel can have careers making films that, you know, may not necessarily reach every senior citizen in Western Queens at first. But, you know, eventually they'll appreciate it when they see it.
Right.
We have to be sort of thankful for these small favors. But listen, I do want to recommend a film, a classic Hollywood film that, Sam, I think you will literally want to actually see.
Mm.
And I recently saw it. It's actually a Western. Oh. I don't know how into Westerns you are. I'm not necessarily a real Western guy. I'm not really a fan of that genre per se.
Well,
like
as you know,
I
am a big fan of the Eastward Westerns, you know, in the not just the spaghetti Westerns, but even things like Josie Wales and Paint Your Wagon Red, High Plains Drifter. Paint Your Wagon Red, not so
sure,
much.
Sure.
That's a joke for those of us in the...
Yeah,
the Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, Paint Your Wagon. That's the film that killed Hollywood and made it ripe for the film breath to come in.
I am also a fan of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. I think that is one of the that film. I think is amazing. Frankly,
Sam Peckinpah. That's a great one. Bob Dylan. Great soundtrack.
Great soundtrack.
Yeah,
and
one.
Also was like the sort of, you know, Unforgiven, which was an Eastwood movie, in my mind was a complete ripoff of Pat Garrett, Billy the Kid, in terms of that notion of, like, you know, this was not as sort of honorable and you know, cool as it was. It was just like guys who could barely shoot well, you know, shooting at each other, basically was it. But yes, I definitely am open to the Western as a genre.
Great. Well, then you're going to love this film because this really does fit into the sort of movement post-Vietnam where the Western stopped being these kind of like moral tales of triumph against the savage and taming the Wild West and started to introduce a little bit of elements of like, oh, wait, there was a concomitant genocide that came with all of these cool shootouts. There was this entire kind of a land grab that we went through. And it wasn't as honorable and noble as you're saying. Like, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid is a great example of that.
McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
The Wild Bunch.
Right, Wild Bunch.
That?
McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Wild Bunch, yes.
Exactly. Good. Wild Bunch, exactly. All these filmmakers started to kind of revisit the Western. And, you know, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, that was Altman. He's a definite auteur. And the two others, Wild Bunch of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, that's Sam Peckinpah, another kind of... auteur, even if he's sort of on the more lowbrow side. This one was actually directed and stars Kirk Douglas, who's not necessarily known for his hard-hitting artistic sensibilities, but he made a film in 1975 called Posse that actually also stars Bruce Dern in one of his greatest roles, I think. I think this is like right up your alley, Sam, because it's basically about a marshal who has political aspirations. He's trying to capture the most wanted man in the West, played by Bruce Dern, who actually winds up being somewhat of the anti-hero because Kirk Douglas is so obviously corrupt. He's basically doing everything he does for political advantage. And without spoiling too much, you kind of watch and see how Bruce Dern as the criminal winds up being the more honorable of the two. So I was highly surprised.
There's a little bit of Billy the Kid in that a little bit too, right? I mean,
yes, that's right. And it's, you know, it's kind of surprising how, you know, and this was sort of early-ish. Well, no, this is like 75, so Vietnam was just ending. But it's really the script surprises you where you think it's going, even when you have your eye on the kind of cynicism that you might be expecting. It's definitely a rewarding and just a surprising, entertaining movie. So now,
my understanding is Kirk Douglas actually directed this.
That's right. I believe I said that. If I didn't, my mistake. But yes, Kirk Douglas directed it.
This was the 70s, early 70s were the best period for film for in terms of like scrutinizing, you know, sort of it was the best way to sort of capture the sort of change in the perspective
Doesn't
that people
Matthew
had.
Know
of,
that you guys both know the actual economics of why that's the case, right?
Yes.
That's fast. That's always interesting to me.
That was that book by Bogdanovich, wrote the Raging Bulls.
Fascinating.
Blankety blank. I can't remember what that book was.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Paint Your Wagon. That was known as kind of like the dead end that the Hollywood studios said, like, we have no idea what America wants right now. This was a huge flop. Let's turn the keys of Hollywood over to this younger generation, which was people like Spielberg and Coppola and Lucas and Scorsese, et cetera, Brian De Palma. And yeah, it did. It was a weird historical blip sometimes between the 70s and basically the early 80s when Star Wars and Jaws made everyone realize like, oh, wait, we don't have to try so hard to make these movies make money. We can just kind of make them spectacles again. That there was this kind of weird blip where the mainstream films actually contained some artistic merit,
yep,
some artistic kind of point of view, and took risks in a commercial sense that today you just won't see. But yeah, Posse fits right in there along the lines of things like, you know, Clute or All the President's Men, 3 Days of the Condor, these things that had a kind of downbeat kind of
The
feeling.
Long
Although
Goodbye.
Posse actually, I think, is happier.
You remember that one, The Long
That's
Goodbye?
Right.
That
Another
was a good
genre
one?
Exercise by Altman. Yeah, Long Goodbye.
Yeah, it was a good era. Picture Show, says Brendan. Or
Last Picture Show,
Last
yeah.
Last Picture Show. Yeah, that was a great era for film. All right, well, Posse, I'm going to watch that ASAP.
It's on iTunes. You can buy it and rent it on iTunes for $4.
On the iTunes. Okay, great. I've heard of that, the iTunes. We will check it out.
iTunes. I pronounce it iTunes.
I will. All right, different folks, different strokes. Matthew Film Guy, as always. An immense pleasure. Thank you so much for your time. I'll give you one chance to plug an eBay product that you have this week. What do you have?
Well, I don't have any auctions going right now. I've put back on all of my high-end Majority Report merchandise. I have the mouse pad. I have the T-shirts. I have the signed bags of air signed by Sam Cedar himself. Bags of actual Majority Report studio air. And you can make me an offer. No offer is too small. Come on in. Oh, clear out my stuff.
Let's take it easy.
And we'll see you there.
All right. Matthew Film Guy, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sam.
I would watch yourself, my friend.
I can tell you that we have not only signed bags of air in this office, but we also have them certified. And as far as I know, Matthew Film Guy's air bags are not certified to be from the air of this office.
There's limited quantities, but there's also more where that came from.
That's there's a little bit of both. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member and support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. As always, if you cannot afford a membership, but you want access to the extra content that we produce every day, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and then wait an extraordinary amount of time for us to get around to you, but we will, and we do. And if you don't hear from us, feel free to email us again, because sometimes our system breaks down, as it were. Also, don't forget, I got sent posters today. Brendan, will you grab that one of those posters? I meant to show that. We got sent a poster. It's in those two slabs of cardboard. Got sent a poster today from... when I was out at Just Coffee in Wisconsin, I saw a poster of Marin's a label. And there's only two labels that they make that are accustomed to podcast shows. One is Marin's at WPTF, and then one is ours. And there it is, the Just Coffee MR poster. This is a collector's item that will not be on Matthew Film Guy's eBay. But you can get the Majority Report blend. As you can see, it's a medium blend. You can also get all sorts of other type of roasts, dark roasts, medium roasts, light roasts.
at justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Today is Friday. Tuesday is also a day. Michael, what happened on Tuesday?
Joshua Kahn taught us, using The Simpsons, how to organize a campaign, going back to the history of leftist organizing. He's the executive director of the Wildfire Project. John Iadarola joined us. We sort of sized up the 2020 field, and we took a lesson from Cornel West on the distinction between buzzwords and showing up to explain how to think strategically and morally about 2020. Patreon.com/TMBS, or become, now we're less than 100 away, one of the first 32,000 subscribers on our YouTube channel.
Jamie.
So we were going to wait until Monday to release this episode of History is a Weapon as a bonus for our patrons, maybe try to get a few more patrons to sign up. But it felt extremely relevant, unfortunately, to the shooting that just happened in New Zealand. So we decided to release it today for free to everyone. So in this History is a Weapon, Sean and Matt Chrisman from Chapa Trap House go over this book from the 1970s called Camp of the Saints by Jean Raspail, which is, you know, currently experiencing something of a renaissance among these right-wing populist figures like Steve Bannon and Marine Le Pen. I took a look at it. It's some of the most horrible racist stuff that you'll ever read in a book. It's about, you know, these like waves of brown immigrants who want to destroy this mythical thing called the West. And I think, you know, it's horrible. It's horrible to look at, but I think it's also really important to understanding the framework, the ideological framework a lot of these people are operating within. And unfortunately, I think it will remain relevant until we confront the roots of this horrible problem. So I'm sorry, that's a little depressing, but
I just had an image of Sam as a as like a Breitbart host being like, it's called Camp of the Saints. It's a really important book about immigration, do you see?
Speaking of books,
tomorrow on Literary Hangover, we're doing the first bestseller, which is actually a book in the genre of racial paranoia, The Captivity Narrative of Mary Rowlandson. Its context, King Philip's War, or Metacomet's Rebellion, as we should probably call it. So look out for that tomorrow.
What do you mean the first bestseller? Was that when they just instituted the metric or what?
I mean, it was like the first notable publication that was printed, basically. Like it was widely sold on both sides of the Atlantic, basically. And if you wanted it in like Virginia, you'd have to buy it from the UK because that's how publishing worked back then. But yeah, it was a big, big seller. Because people were very interested in Native American life and Native Americans in general, because they didn't know much about them and they were colonizing their land. But you could never hear about it unless it was either through a missionary narrative or a captivity narrative, because if somebody actually just went and became part of the Native Americans, which a lot of colonists did, they wouldn't be allowed to write about it.
You know, it would be fun, Matt, and if you did like something like the Da Vinci Code too, like you just mixed in a couple of like really wildly bad books.
It's not.
That
I mean,
might be fun.
There has in the early days before Literary Hangover was launched.
The early days.
Well,
yes.
There was a pilot episode of 50 Shades of Grey.
Which one?
50 Shades of Grey.
Oh, dude.
Nice.
That was on the Informationer feed.
Yeah, get that out there.
All right, folks. Quick break.
I want to hear a high Matt talking about it.
Head into the fun half. We'll be right back.
Calling from a 919 area code. Who's this?
Where are you calling from?
Wow. Awesome. Well, let's just do this exercise.
Okay, do it.
Whoa. Super sick.
It's all good.
super sick.
Hell yeah.
Right. You don't need the means test, Social Security. You don't need the means test.
Medicare.
Nobody cares.
The way that you
means test that.
You tax wealthy people more.
What's the point?
And that's just simply not enough.
And as you always say, as soon as you stick in that access, then we already do have universal health.
I have access to BMW.
Right.
This is a weird, weird, weird
time for politics right now.
That's legit.
Galaxy brain.
This is a freak shit.
Love it all.
He finally gets to fulfill his destiny. Burger sommelier. Gusto little baby.
Very legal.
Very cool.
I thought this was a joke.
Hamburger glared.
Well, I mean, but things are really bad. Bad. But.